Welcome to New Books in Popular Music, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Matt Smith-Larman. In this episode, I talk with Sarah Marcus about her book, Girls to the Front, The True Story of the Riot Grrrl Revolution, published in 2010 by Harper Perennial. Punk rock of the 1970s and hardcore in the 1980s provided an avenue for disaffected youth not only to express their anti-establishment selves, but also to find a community of similar others, people who would accept them for who they were. Many outcast women and girls who gravitated to punk, however, found it to be a mirror of the patriarchal and sexist society from which they were fleeing. In Girls to the Front, Sarah Marcus details the Riot Grrrl movement as girl punk rock, as girl politics, as girl power. The movement has its beginnings in Olympia, Washington in the form of the bands Bikini Kill and Bratmobile, but quickly moves to D.C. to join forces with the overtly political punk hardcore scene that had been established there since the early 80s. Riot Grrrls not only formed bands, they organized and attended local, regional, and national political events, they created and distributed fanzines, they organized conferences, they made the area in front of a rock and roll stage safe for girls. Marcus describes this movement as it existed from its beginnings in 1989 through its publicly most prominent years from 1992 to 94 to its fade from public consciousness in the 95 and beyond. At its best, Riot Grrrl empowered girls, many were in their mid to late teens, to be themselves, to not feel a need to kowtow to an image of themselves created by economically, culturally, and politically powerful men. At its worst, infighting, hyper-regionalism, and co-optation into the mainstream kept Riot Grrrl from lasting much longer than the 6 years described by Marcus. Nonetheless, the Riot Grrrl movement of the early 90s served a purpose. It gave a generation of young women a platform to remake feminism anew, in their own image. Sarah Marcus lives in Brooklyn, which is where I reached her for this interview. Hello, Sarah, and welcome to New Books in Popular Music.
Thanks, Matt. It's nice to be here.
Great. So, why don't we start by having you tell us a little bit about your biography, where are you from, that kind of stuff.
Well, I grew up in Maryland, outside Washington, D.C., and I had the good fortune to be doing so in the early and mid-90s, which was a pretty fertile time for indie music, DIY music in D.C. I mean, the 80s had also been fertile, but there were a lot of really great bands to see when I was in high school, and also there was this Riot Grrrl thing happening, and I had been interested in feminism from an early age, but had never quite found my people, never quite found a community within which I could like think about my feminist ideas and act on them. And so when the punk feminist movement of young women known as Riot Grrrl got started in D.C., or in my case, a couple years after it got started, it was a really marvelous place for me to land as a teenager going to a kind of bland public high school and living pretty far out in the suburbs, feeling pretty disconnected from any cool culture years and years before the internet, and really not having any idea of how to connect with it. Riot Grrrl is a really fantastic find for me and for some of my friends. So that was my teenage existence. I made a zine with a friend, and then I went and made a zine on my own, and I started a band with a couple of friends, and then I went off to college and kept playing music and kept writing.
Where did you go to college?
I kind of went around. I started off at Yale, and then after a year and a half, I transferred to Oberlin, and I think I'm pretty much I'm a product of the two kind of combined. They were both good places for some stuff and not as good places for other stuff, and I'm glad I got to do them both.
And so pretty early on, you started identifying yourself as a feminist?
Yeah. I was certainly, like, conscious about it by ninth grade, for sure. I think that maybe before ninth grade, it was just, like, the ideas that were in my family, so I didn't realize they were unusual. I just thought that, like, probably everybody's parents were, like, happing them to how ridiculous it was that in the Toys R Us catalog there were boy toys and girl toys, and isn't that dumb? You know, there certain things that people don't quite realize until later on aren't just shared throughout the culture.
So a lot of this came through your parents, you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, there was just kind of a real reflexive 70s feminism that ruled in my family. I was brought up on Free to Be You and Me, like the anti-sexist children's record and book that, you know, we listened to that all the time. And I was definitely told constantly that as a girl, I could do anything I wanted. But when you get into adolescence and you get into high school, there, and you go through puberty, you start to realize that there are definite, like, footnotes and asterisks and special terms and conditions that attend to that promise of unlimitedness. And that, that dissonance, I think, was a lot of what fueled, Riot Girl.
Mm-hmm. So how did you come to write this book, Girls to the Front?
Well, I was writing about music, and I was writing about feminism, and I was writing about activism for various magazines and newspapers and on my own. And I realized that Riot Girl was being talked about, but not in a way that I really recognized it. Like, at least in the, Riot Girl was still spoken of in the rock and roll world, but it was spoken of just as a musical movement, and people didn't really talk about the politics as if they had been an important part of it. At the same time, my day job was at a foundation that funded community organizing, and among other things, we funded youth organizing. And so I was looking at these youth organizing models and starting to see my and my friends' experience in Riot Girl through that lens of, like, there was this language for young people trying to identify what's wrong in their lives and what's wrong in their communities and what can they do about it and how can we express ourselves and the whole nine yards. And it kind of blew my mind that this was a major element of Riot Girl that was not really being discussed and that was kind of falling out of the discourse altogether. So it started to feel very important to me to stick that back in there and that there was a story that wasn't being told about the politics of female adolescence and the politics of female adolescence in the 90s as a particular moment in history and how ideas about women and young women and young women's bodies were active in. I mean, this was not stuff that I knew. A lot of this I figured out as I was writing it. It's not like in 2001 I'd said, oh, I think that maybe, like, anxiety about young women's sexuality was, like, a huge impact or a huge element of, like, macro political debates in the U.S. around the 1992 presidential election. No, I figured that out in researching it. But I did just have this feeling that there was a story that wasn't being told, and I wanted to make sure it got told. And I knew that Riot Girl was seen as a story worth telling, and it seemed to me that it felt important to me that the story that got told was a story that wasn't purely about music. And it also seemed to me that that was something that was going to be hard for someone who hadn't been really intimately connected with the scene to do, because it hadn't really been documented. Most of the research I did for my book was interviews.
Mm-hmm. So let's back up just a little bit. When did you first know that Riot Girl existed? What was your first exposure to it as, I guess, a teenager?
My first exposure to it as a teenager was an article that came out in Newsweek magazine. It was like October or November 1993. I mean, I can look it up right now.
I'm looking at my notes.
It was 1992. It was November 22nd, 1992. And we got Newsweek in my house, and I read the article, and I was just like, wow, this is exactly what I've been looking for. And from that point, it took a while to actually find them because there was no internet. You couldn't Google it. And I, like, looked in the phone book, and I looked in the Washington Post's, like, meetings classifieds. And, I mean, this is, like, you couldn't even really find out where punk shows were happening from reading the Washington Post. That might be different now, but at the time, that's, these shows were not being advertised broadly. And certainly the meetings were not. So I just kind of set off on my own to be a feminist on my own and hope that someday I would find other people. And so I founded a feminist club at my school, and I started a zine with my friend, and just kind of, like, I guess did what I figured Riot Girls probably were doing, even though I couldn't find them. And then eventually I found an address for the DC chapter, which was printed in a long-running feminist newspaper of sorts out of Washington, D.C., which was called Off Our Backs, all lowercase letters. And so I sent a letter, and after a couple months, I got word back that meetings were happening every week, and here's where they are, and here's the phone number, and here's the address, and so I went. So that was 11th grade. That was the end of 11th grade when I finally got in there.
Let's jump into Riot Girl Self, and since this show is new books and popular music, let's at least start with the music part, and we'll drift into the more political part, but talk about Bikini Kill and how they're kind of the beginning of it all.
Bikini Kill was this band that got started in Olympia, Washington. I want to say in 1990, I think they first got together in late 90, and it was a result of a kind of meeting of the minds of these two very fierce and precise and ardent feminist thinkers and musicians in Olympia, Washington, one of them being Toby Vale, who had been in the band The Go Team with Calvin Johnson starting when she was a teenager. And she made this amazing fanzine called Jigsaw, which Kathleen Hanna, who ran a gallery performance venue in downtown Olympia with some of her artist friends, had read. She had read the zine. She was playing music after an encounter with the writer Kathy Acker, in which Acker had told her that if she wanted people to listen to her, she should, instead of just doing spoken word, start a band, because people listen to bands more than spoken word artists. And so Kathleen had started a band. She had started one band called I Heart Amy Carter, and then she'd started another band called Viva Knievel, and she was on tour with that band when she was reading Toby Vale's zine, and she thought, we really need to be friends and talk about feminism, and this person is thinking about a lot of the same things that I'm thinking about, and I just wanted to get to know her better. Like, even though Olympia is a small town, it's easy to kind of know who people are without knowing them very well, and that was what had been the case with Kathleen Hanna and Toby Vale. So Kathleen gets back from tour, and they start a band, and they call it Bikini Kill, and they recruit Kathy Wilcox, who's this fabulous bassist, and for the other guitarist, after a while, they settled on this guy, Billy Caron, who was a marvelous guitar player, and Toby was mostly drumming, and Kathleen was mostly singing, although they switched around between songs often. And that band, by 1991, which had a really tight set and was wowing audiences in Washington, D.C., and that was how they... That was one reason that they decided to spend the summer in Washington, D.C. in 1991, which is how Riot Girl really got started there. But the ideas fueling Riot Girl were kind of bouncing around among a group of friends and zines and letters and conversations for months leading up to the first meeting, which was in D.C. in 91.
And the other important band is Bratmobile, right? Can you tell us about them?
Right, the other important band in the inception, sure, because Bratmobile is, in 1991, Bratmobile is these two friends who go to the University of Oregon in Eugene, Allison Wolf and Molly Neumann, and then they They're just kind of doing one-off a cappella things at parties and between other bands around Eugene. And then Calvin Johnson offers them a show opening for Bikini Kill in Olympia on Valentine's Day 1991. And that is Bratmobile's first real, like, plugged-in, we wrote a set of our own songs show. That spring, they go to D.C. for spring break, and they meet this guitarist, Erin Smith, and she becomes the third member of Bratmobile. So the summer 1991 in D.C. is not only Bikini Kill going to live in D.C. for the summer, but Bratmobile as well going to live there and hang out and play music and make zines together and eventually also call a meeting that would spark a movement of sorts.
So did the Bikini Kill and Bratmobile people know each other before they went down to D.C.?
Yeah, they knew each other in Olympia. So the Bratmobile people would come up to Olympia to hang out all the time because Allison was actually from Olympia. So that was kind of their... Eugene was so boring and it was so lame and there were no cool bands in Eugene, blah, blah, blah. So they would go up to Olympia on weekends to hang out and go to shows. And they were, and they met Toby at a show and they were like, we really love your zine. And she was like, you guys should do a zine. And so they did. And you know, in Olympia, that was really what it took. You just had to create something, put something out there, and then people would really kind of respect you as a peer. And so they were like, we're going to do a zine, we're going to call it Girl Germs. And they went around when they made their first issue and like handed it out to people throughout Olympia. And then they were, even though they were like very, quite young college students, they were invited and welcomed into the scene as people who were making things.
So... in what ways, before we get into DC too much though, in what ways, especially Bikini Kill and Bratmobile, were they consciously feminist? I mean, what, looking at the bands, listening to the music, etc., what ways did they present themselves as feminist?
Well, Bikini Kill's kind of theme song began, we're Bikini Kill, and we want revolution, girl style now. Like, that's pretty blatantly feminist.
Mm-hmm.
Bikini Kill's songs from the get-go were real kind of feminist fight songs, manifestos, what have you. Bratmobile, it was a little more... it was not quite as manifesto-y. The songs would kind of dramatize or make fun of sexist structures. So, you know, girl germs, no returns, can't hide out there everywhere. Just like about difficulties between boys and girls being friends and just like actually having meaningful relationships by pulling it back to the playground when girls were like gross. And if you touched a girl, then you had girl germs if you were a boy. So, but I would say that in both cases, Bikini Kill and Bratmobile, there's also something feminist in getting up and playing music as women and not asking to have their identities as women ignored or superseded by the music, but asking to have it all viewed at once. Like, our creative output is informed by the experience that we've had as women in the culture. And that was something that would come out in interviews more than in the shows themselves. But I do think that the way that they constructed themselves as performers was feminist inherently.
So, they go to D.C. in, is it 91? Is that right? The summer of 91?
Summer 91.
And what happens there? This is when Riot Girl really starts to take form as a movement.
Yeah, well, they start making a weekly mini zine, and they title it Riot Girl. And they make a couple issues of this, and they pass it out at shows. And then at a certain point, they want to take it further, and so they call a meeting, and they publish the announcement of this meeting in one of the issues of their zines, and it calls for an all-girl meeting to discuss the status of punk rock and revolution. And a bunch of people show up, and that's the start of it.
Now, DC already had a, you know, with bands like Minor Threat and Discord Records, they already had kind of a structure, albeit, a male-dominated structure. Does that play into this?
Well, I mean, there's a couple different structures within DC Punk, and they're interlocking, but they're not entirely coextensive with each other. So Minor Threat, and then growing out of Minor Threat Fugazi, is the whole Discord scene, the Discord record label, which is run in large part by Ian MacKay of Minor Threat and then Fugazi. And by 1991, 92, Fugazi are like this major breakout crossover popular band outside of purely the punk scene. And popular without compromising, without without going to a major label, without outsourcing the production of their t-shirts, without letting any shows cost more than $5, like very, very principled and becoming pretty popular within that framework. So that's the Discord thing. And as you mentioned, yeah, it's like there are certainly women working on Discord, and there are always women like working for the label, but the bands that the label is making its reputation on are guy bands, and the stars are men. Then the other structure that's relevant in our discussion here is the structure of the punk activist group Positive Force, which was the group still exists, but at the time it was also a house in Arlington, Virginia, where a rotating cast of characters would live, and they would have meetings, and they would put on benefit shows, and they would do protests, and it was a real, it had been around by that point. I think they were founded in like 85 or 86. So by 1991, they're quite established in the scene. At their helm is this lovely, gentle, radical man named Mark Anderson, who really endeavors to make Positive Force a welcoming place for everybody. And it is not a all-male group at all. There are totally women involved with it. And it's largely quite young people. And that setup, in fact, is where the first Riot Girl meeting is held. It's like, okay, let's not create everything from scratch, but we can work within this infrastructure that's been set up. There's a house. Meetings can happen there. It has a phone number. It has a P.O. box. People know where it is already. And that was crucial. And there was never, it seems to me, much of a point where, like, Positive Force got targeted as, like, the patriarchy. There were moments where a little bit of that got directed at Fugazi, for sure. I see it as a useful corrective when a community's growing. Sometimes there's conflict to have growth.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't there sometimes, as you mentioned, when, say, Bikini Kill or whoever would play on a bill with Fugazi, was there sometimes friction maybe among the audience or the bands, the feminists, and then a more feminist audience for the Riot Girl bands, but then you'd have a more traditional kind of macho kind of punk rocky skinhead crowd for Fugazi?
Right, well, I think you're probably referring to the show at the Supreme Court. It was like a protest show outside the Supreme Court, which was held in the summer of 1992. And yeah, there were some clashes because Bikini Kill and Fugazi were playing, and Bikini Kill played first, and there were a bunch of, like, Fugazi had just drawn a massive crowd, and a massive crowd of that I'm sure included no small number of men who liked to show their enthusiasm for bands by smashing into each other at great velocity and with great force. And while certainly there are some women who also like to show their appreciation for bands in this manner, it was a really big thing within Riot Girl to say, why do we have to, like, be cowering on the sidelines from shows because we're afraid that this, like, meatheady guy is gonna, like, slam into us or grab our tits or whatever. So people were trying to kind of hold their ground, and there was a little bit of a scuffle in the audience during the Fugazi set. That did happen. And, it's just a, I don't know what else there is to say about that. Was there a question you wanted to ask me about
it? Well, I suppose one of the strategies, I don't know if it's considered a political strategy or what, but a Riot Girl strategy was this taking back of the front of the stage, right? I mean, you write about how, you know, they would go forward and they would hold hands, creating kind of a barrier for girls. And during shows, they would, you know, when say Bikini Kill was playing, they would encourage girls to come to the front, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. And that would happen more and more, especially as people would, like, direct violence at Bikini Kill, like, during shows or after shows. It became almost a safe, not almost, it became a safety thing where the members of Bikini Kill were like, we want to have a row of women in the front of, or a row of girls and women in the front of the show so that we know that, like, so that we can be reasonably sure that there's not going to be somebody in the front row who just, like, reaches up and tries to punch us. There, you know, there's the part in the book that talks about how this guy who had been heckling Bikini Kill and had kind of in a show in Boston and had sort of gotten into a fight with some of them afterward was, oh, short while later, he killed his ex-girlfriend whom he had been stalking and then shot himself. So there was a sense that the kind of vociferous reactions that sometimes got directed at Bikini Kill weren't necessarily just happening on a level of, like, words in a venue, but that some of these people were actually violent and actually dangerous. So it was kind of a practical matter to say, let's have all the girls get together in the front of the show so that you're not... so that you don't have to kind of be, like, stuck in the middle, surrounded by a bunch of guys, and somebody's fucking with you, and you can't really get out because it's too crowded. Like, let's have you all in the front. Also, you know, generally girls are a little shorter than guys, and then you can see better. And then, like, the guys in the back can see, too. I mean, I don't know how tall you are, but so many times I'm, like, at a show, and then some 6-foot-tall guy, like, stands directly in front of me. And I'm like, God, it'd sure be nice to be at a girls to the front show right now.
Sure. And I mean, it just, I understand practically well, but symbolically also that, you know, in a traditional rock show, especially at a club, it's always, you know, 2 or 3 rows of sweaty, fairly drunk guys. And I can see, you know, anybody small, but women especially, and girls would have a tough time getting to the front.
Yeah. Yeah, that can be true. It was a powerful thing.
So,
it's so powerful because you think about punk rock, and especially in the early 90s, as a female, I was almost always going to be in the minority at the audience of a punk show. It's going to be more than half guys. And a lot of what Riot Girl was about was just not like let's just create an all-female community and, you know, kick the men out altogether, but like what would happen if we just kind of all got together and talked as girls and like knew each other and had that as a community too. So to have all the girls at the front, then you can look around and you can be like, oh, I've seen you sort of across the room at shows for weeks, but never really talked to you. What's your name? And then go ahead.
I was going to switch gears a little bit. So if you wanted to finish that.
No, no. I was okay. Talking because you were quiet.
What was the relationship between Riot Girl and earlier feminist movements, especially, I suppose, maybe the parents of some of these girls, did the Riot Girl embrace older feminist movement? In what ways did they want to change it?
Well, a lot of the thinkers, the earlier feminist thinkers, were our textbooks and were our inspirations. We were all reading bell hooks and Angela Davis. I know I was reading a ton of Adrienne Rich. I'm sure a lot of other people were also. I remember writing about Adrienne Rich, like, in my zine. These were our source books, absolutely. As for just the institutions that had been built through the 70s and 80s, like the National Organization for Women, and NARAL, Feminist Majority, that kind of stuff. I mean, a lot of them in the early 90s were really focused on electoral strategies, which made sense and were strategic given the situation. They were trying to avoid a second term for George H.W. Bush and trying to get women into Congress and trying to get Democratic majorities and all the rest. But that doesn't leave much to do. A, it doesn't leave much to do for women, for people who aren't 18 yet and can't vote. And B, it's kind of like incremental institutional change, which might not speak the most directly to the issues of greatest importance to the people who are drawn to Riot Girl, who are more like focused on everyday stuff, like how do I stop that guy from bugging me at school? How do I learn to play drums when, like, everyone that I know who has drums is a guy who says girls can't play drums and won't teach me. That, by the way, was not my experience. I had a couple of really marvelous male friends who would teach me drums, but then when I would get together to jam with my male friends and all of their male friends, nobody would let me play the drums. They would just hand me the microphone. So I do want to call out that there's a range of behaviors, and I had a lot of support, but I also had a lot of frustration. But anyway, none of this stuff is addressed by, like, electoral politics. And not that it should be. It's just, it's different fronts. But so these institutions, the institutionalized feminist organizations in the early 90s, for the most part, just weren't having the same conversation that the girls wanted to be having. So there wasn't a real sense of we can go into these organizations and completely revise their priorities. It was just, oh, well, they're doing their thing and we're doing our thing. And I should say, I did do stuff with NOW. I mean, the feminist club that I started at my high school was actually a NOW club because the Montgomery County, Maryland chapter of the National Organization for Women at least was kind of keeping tabs on who was doing high school organizing and connecting us all to each other. And that was all they were doing. There was nothing else on the agenda for the chapter that was of any interest to us. But to give them credit, they did make sure that we connected to each other and that we were able to work with one another. And also, they, in 1995, when I was a senior in high school, NOW put on a National Young Feminist Summit and invited me and some of the other high school club presidents to be on an advisory board and to help plan the summit. So did anything come of that summit? I'm not sure. But they didn't have their heads completely in the sand. They got it to some extent.
And Riot Girl, especially in D.C., they participated in a lot of, I'm not sure if mainstream is the term, but, marches and protests and such, right, that you write about in the book.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would definitely call the 1992 March for Women's Lives mainstream. Absolutely. Movie stars were there, and it was huge, and all the Democratic presidential candidates showed up and marched. It was quite mainstream. That was not a radical, act at all. I mean, you could say it was a radical act, but it wasn't a radical action from some fringe organization. It was very, very major. And the Riot Girls were there, and the Riot Girls were like, oh, we hate these chants, we're just gonna scream. We're not going to go 2, 4, 6, 8, blah, blah, blah. We're going to go, ah! But marched together and had a banner. So, you know, that's I think, also part of the positive force model which was to, like, do your own things, but also, like, show up for the big stuff that's happening on the mall. It's really quite something to grow up in D.C. and to have national politics be local politics, to have federal issues be playing out a couple of miles from where you go to high school. This stuff feels tangible in a way that it perhaps doesn't in other parts of the country.
What about the role of literature? You've mentioned zines quite a few times, and it seems from your book that, I mean, everybody was putting out. I mean, sometimes it'd be just one issue. Talk about literature and the role that it played in Riot Girl, their own literature, self-produced.
Zines were how people communicated. There weren't blogs. There weren't online message boards. Telephone calls, long-distance phone calls were very expensive. And I think that it matters that the zine, the handmade magazine, was this major mode of communication because zines favor in-depth thought. Zines favor the essay form. They also have a lot of space for collage and for cut-ups and for image-based communication, but it's also really easy to, like, write a 4-page essay and, like, cut up every paragraph and paste it onto a nice background that you've appropriated from some magazine somewhere, and really have an in-depth dialogue with your readers about certain issues and try and figure out what you think about things. So these, there were a couple of networking tools via which people found each other's zines. There was a newsletter called the Action Girl Newsletter. There was this distribution service called Riot Girl Press. There was another distribution service called GRLL out of Chicago. There was the newsletter Queer Zine Explosion, done by Larry Bob for a very long time out of San Francisco, which included a number of Riot Girl affiliated zines as well. And so this was a major way that people got to hear what everyone else was thinking about. And you would read a zine and you would, like, write a long letter back to the person about what they had written. You wouldn't just read it and go on with your life without giving something back in return.
What about the writing on themselves, you know, on their bodies, that part of the literature? Can that be considered literature? I don't know.
I think that's a marvelous thought. Yeah, we can think of it as literature. They're very short works of literature, one or two words. You know, to just write girl love on your stomach or rape or... I remember by this march in 1995, my friends and I were just, like, drawing women's symbols on our arms. I don't know if that's a symbolic literature, I suppose. But, yeah, it's like, all right, if our bodies are made to stand for a certain set of meanings within our culture, let's interfere in that process. Let's have some say over it. Let's put the meanings that we choose, or meanings that we don't choose and that we want to ironically call attention to, as in the case where Kathleen would write slut on her stomach and then take her shirt off at a show. But it's like, let's give ourselves some agency in this instead of just having politicians at their party conventions discussing what our bodies mean.
So with using some terms, like, say, putting slut on one's stomach or property or whatever it might be, is this similar to some other movements like civil rights movements, gay rights movements, in appropriating terms from the dominant culture as your own? I'm a sociologist by training, so.
I think the word girl were operated that way. The word slut, not so much. I mean, that maybe, if you expand your purview and think forward to, like, last year with the slut walks, that's where that became, in a way, like, that became, like, Queer Nation. And I think that Queer Nation was, to call the group Queer Nation, predated the widespread use of the word queer for, like, who, what people really identified as. So I don't know if these slut walks are going to presage some kind of widespread self-identification among women as sluts, but I'm not really sure that that is going to happen, because I think that that operation was not to say, yes, we are sluts and you can't use that word against us, as with queer or fag or other stuff, but more to say, like, the way that the dominant culture uses that word, the word slut, is, you know, imprecise and oppressive. And we're just going to throw it back at you to show you how ridiculous the way that you're using it as at us is. But I think that's a slightly different operation. As for the word girl, of course, the feminist movement had made the word girl persona non grata. Obviously a word is not a person, but had made the word girl exile, not good feminism, and so forth in the 70s. And rightly so, because a woman who's like 45 years old and successful in her career, or not, and just like, once you're a grown-up, you have the right to be treated like a grown-up and not be spoken to like you're a child. But when you're a young person, maybe there's nothing shameful about being a young person if that's what you are. If you're 15, maybe you're just a girl. Not just, but like, maybe it is simply true that you are a girl. And that's fine, and it's not offensive to say that you're a girl. And even maybe into 20, if you want to continue to claim, or 25, if you want to continue to claim that kind of open-endedness of youth. And also maybe a kind of like campiness, like, oh, girl, there could be some of that too. Get on, girl.
But there's the changing of the spelling too. I think that's important in using the term girl.
Yeah, but it wasn't always used. I mean, it's not like people would then write zines and say, who am I? I'm a 17-year-old girl living in Topeka, Kansas, and would use the G-R-R-R-L. Not always at all. It was probably more common in regular discourse to spell girl G-I-R-L. So it wasn't like W-O-M-Y-N, like replacing W-O-M-E-N because women with an E is too male-identified, and so we're going to only spell it with a Y. It was interchangeable. The using girl with the three R's was like a marvelous innovation that has, of course, today spread, and you see it in all kinds of things that have absolutely nothing to do with Riot Girl, because it's just such an easy thing to grasp. When you see G-R-R-R-L, nobody has to tell you what that means. That means the girl who's tough. Great, I got it. It was wonderful. But in that way also, I think that it doesn't quite fit into the same reclaiming of a slur if you're twisting it to reclaim. Then you're not really reclaiming it, you're renovating it. And that could be said to be a slightly different operation.
Mm-hmm. Well, what role did the intersections, you write about this, of race and class and sexuality play in Riot Girl? I mean, they weren't strictly educated, middle, upper class, white kind of movement, were they? There was some conflict there, you write about.
Yeah, not purely. There were certainly a range of class experiences within the group. There were a range of racial and ethnic identities and backgrounds within the group, a range of sexualities. And there was a hunger to address them and an awareness of the importance of addressing them that was sometimes not quite matched by the ability to know how to address them, because there are difficult things that have stymied feminist and other social justice movements for decades, the structures of oppression along especially lines of race and class in the U.S. are really deep and at times seem intractable and certainly murky and minefieldy. So people tried, and sometimes it did not go as well as one might have hoped. And there were certainly people who felt that Riot Girl was mostly white and they didn't belong there because they weren't white. Less so in terms of class, because punk has a tendency to be such a masker of class differences because everybody's shopping at the thrift store. And going to $5 shows, there aren't really cultural markers so much within this setting of a punk scene that are going to create big class divides where some people are like, wow, I can't afford to do that stuff that everyone else is doing. And also, my clothes are dirtier. In fact, some people from working class backgrounds that I talked to for the book talked about how liberating it was to get into punk and be like, oh, wow, this thing that we had been shamed about our whole lives, namely shopping at the Goodwill for our clothes, suddenly it was cool. Suddenly it made us cool to have, like, secondhand clothes. It was really great. It was a way to stop feeling ashamed of this part of where we came from. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that, like, class structures were necessarily always adequately addressed within Riot Girl, especially because, you know, there was a range, but there wasn't a huge range. There was nobody, like, living in like, destitute poverty, I don't think, coming to meetings. I'm probably going to get an email tomorrow from somebody who that describes. Stop erasing me yet. I'm sorry. I didn't know. I will go back and revise. But I'm not aware, you know, I'm not aware of it having extended all the way to the absolute bottom of the socioeconomic ladder in the U.S.
So back to the music specifically, what role did punk as a genre going back to the 1970s, you know, how aware were Riot Girls of this history? What parts did they pick and choose as their own? Because, you know, starting as it moves into punk, moves into hardcore, it becomes a more masculine, you know, jockey kind of thing, whereas earlier punk did not seem to be that way.
Yeah, well, one of the classic scene pieces that Toby Vail wrote in Jigsaw was about the Go-Go's, and was defending the Go-Go's and saying, come on, you music guys, stop saying that the Go-Go's suck. They were amazing. And you're just being annoying because you don't like women or something. So there was that awareness. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that we have, like, really great access to now was a lot harder to get your hands on then. Like, I don't think X-ray specs had been reissued, so you had to find somebody who had found a used copy who would make a tape for you and so forth. A lot of punk in the early 90s was kind of the freedom of creating ex nihilo. I love this story where Bratmobile has been offered this first show in Olympia, and they think, oh my god, how do we write a set of songs? They go to talk to a friend of theirs, a musician friend, who says, just listen to the Ramones, you'll figure something out. And then Allison goes, and then I was like, well, if this punk guy tells me that listening to the Ramones is the way to have a band, then I'm not going to listen to the Ramones, so that I can sound different.
A big influence, I think, was probably Beat Happening, and you've mentioned Calvin a few times, right?
I mean, Beat Happening was Allison and Molly's, like, favorite band. Because they would just make music that sounded however they wanted. They would, like, do really stripped down stuff. They would switch instruments a lot. And it was like very, very creative and not like hyper skilled. So it was a really marvelous role model to have as a young person who's hardly played music before, but really just wants to like plug in, write a couple songs and get up on stage.
And what influence did the whole, of course, grunge thing have, and Nirvana, of course, you know, this all happens at the same time, where all of a sudden the nation, the world is focused on this area, and this is where Riot Girl is kind of happening too. What did that do to the Riot Girl movement? What influence?
I think that it, I think it made the outside world much more interested in hearing about Riot Girl. I think that without grunge, there might have been less coverage. You know, there was a ton of press coverage of Riot Girl around 1992, 93 in particular. I think part of that was because it was connected to Olympia, which was near Seattle, and not everybody writing these articles knew that there was this bond, that Toby and Kurt were close, or that Kathleen and, I guess Kathleen and Dave Grohl had gone out briefly, and they had played a show together in Seattle on Halloween in 1991. And whether or not people knew that exactly, I think that the veneer of grunge and the veneer of the Northwest kind of attached itself a little bit to these groups in the eyes of the media, making them more interesting for the media and for a national audience. Now, if that was good or bad, that's a more complicated question than we have the time in the next 4 minutes to get into.
Well, how about you talk a little bit about the influence that the conflict, I guess, brought on by this now national exposure. You write about Newsweek and Spin, a few you know, national magazines start focusing on, and this seems in your story to be the beginning maybe of the dissolution of Riot Girl.
It's complicated. It's really difficult to say that the media coverage was a total curse or an unmitigated blessing. It's all somewhere in between, in the middle.
How about this then? How about, did Riot Girl, did it have an end? Is it still going?
Yes.
How did it end?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I was sort of answering, well, I guess I was answering yes to both of your questions.
That's how I took it, yeah.
Yeah. I think that it, at a certain point in time, it petered out, and there was probably a little while where very few people would have been willing to identify themselves as Riot Girls, but now there's a whole new crop of people who are very happy to claim an identification with and inspiration from the movement, and I think that speaks to the enduring power of the ideas and the energy behind it, and of the music.
So there are still young women calling themselves Riot Girls now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, not...
Are there still chapters of Riot Girl meetings?
I get emails every so often that there are chapters. Now, what exactly do these chapters do is not in the emails. So, I mean, I know that there are some shows sometimes. I know that there's... Actually, I did an event in Berlin, in Germany, that was co-sponsored by Riot Girl Berlin. And from what I could tell, Riot Girl Berlin mostly puts on events.
I don't know if they also have like consciousness raising meetings where they pass bell hooks books around and discuss sexual harassment. I don't know. But I know that people are definitely still being influenced by the ideas, and including young people who were not around the first time.
And how have I got this phrase in your book, and so I'm going to ask, did many of these players, Kathleen, Toby, others, did they grow up to be the, what kind of adults have they grown up to be? Have they grown up the way their parents intended them to grow up?
I don't really know their parents, any of their parents.
How about parents, generically speaking, mainstream American parents?
No, I just don't. I don't think that it's safe to make that kind of assumption. Because I know, for example, Alison Wolfe's mother was a lesbian feminist who had founded the first women's health clinic in Thurston County, Washington. Molly Neumann's parents were like really political, like Democratic activists who worked on Capitol Hill. So the kind of like typical suburban, oh no dear, don't go out there, it's dangerous people. I don't know how many of these folks really came from that stereotype. I think that basically almost everyone I talked to for the book has charted their own way through life in a really beautiful and inspiring and original way. People have taken lessons of DIY and the lessons of Riot Girl and applied them to how they go through life. You know, you write your own ticket and you decide what you want things to look like and then you make it happen instead of just signing up for one of the prefabricated die-cast options that's held out to you. And I think that that's something for everyone to be proud of.
And so how about you, Sarah? What are you up to? Are you writing these days? What are you doing?
I've been writing a lot of criticism, actually, of books mostly. I also wrote a piece for the LA Review of Books when Occupy was happening about the aesthetics of the live stream and what that meant for activist video. And I'm actually gearing up to start a PhD in English where I'm going to be writing about political commitment and political disappointment in the 20th century.
Fabulous. Thank you for writing the book. I think many people like me saw it mainly as a music genre. And so I think it's a light enlightening for us. And thank you for being on our show.
Well, thanks for having me, Matt. It was very pleasurable.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Sarah Marcus about her book, Girls to the Front, The True Story of the Riot Girl Revolution, published by Harper Perennial in 2010. Check back with New Books in Popular Music regularly for more interviews with authors of books about popular music. I'm your host, Matt Smith-Larman. Thanks for listening.